I'm losing my mind just a little.
It's time now for Setting the Record Straight on KOHI with Melinda Bernard. You can call the show now at 503-397-1600 or toll free at 877-397-1632. The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KOHI, staff, management, or sponsors. Now, here's Melinda.
Good morning. Welcome to Setting the Record Straight. Happy Friday, everyone. Today, we are talking about the Electoral College, the national popular vote, and who is going to be casting the votes for president in Oregon, and how were these folks chosen. But first, we're going with our Friday morning frequent guest, Mike Paul. Mike is the director of Columbia County Public Health. Good morning, Mike. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So what is our update for this week in Columbia County? How are things going on the COVID front?
Well, unfortunately, it's more of the same this week. We're still seeing about 10 to 15 cases, new cases per day. Those are confirmed cases, lab-confirmed cases. We think the number is much higher. We have had a couple of days in the last month with more than 20 cases in one day, which is much higher than we've had all year long. So we are still in, as we have been the last couple of weeks, the state puts us in an extreme risk category based on our case rate and our test positivity, the number of people who test positive of all the people who go test is high enough to put us in the extreme risk category.
So do you have a theory on why the cases have surged out here all of a sudden?
Well, right now, I think we're starting to see new cases from holiday gatherings. It's also just, you know, that time of year where we know coronavirus transmission is much more likely indoors with less ventilation and, you know, people may not wear masks around people that are familiar to them, and so they you know, we're seeing a lot of household transmission, actually.
So you're more likely to get COVID from somebody who's in your home as opposed to going to the gas station or the grocery store?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what the data shows, is that we're seeing household cases or workplace cases or you know, just cases where people are gathering with people they know.
What about religious holidays? Hanukkah started two nights ago, I believe, or maybe perhaps last night, and Christmas is coming, and folks are tending to attend church and synagogue services more frequently. And at this point, I believe that places of worship can have up to a quarter of their capacity. So if your church holds 400 or your synagogue holds 400, that means 100 people can foreseeably gather. Is there any data on those kind of services and COVID transmission?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of data on gathering. We have seen religious gatherings as well as you know, political gatherings, different kinds of gatherings, again, indoors where people are close together. Some we've even seen cases where there have been, you know, singing groups where there's been a lot of transmission. And, you know, this is the month where we know people gather. So we're definitely concerned and hope that people will decide to, you know, do something different this year, meet virtually or, you know, do an event outside. Right now, really, we're in this category where it's where the recommendation is only six people per gathering, only two different households.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the outbreak. We have at least one confirmed outbreak in Columbia County at Congregate Care, which is a skilled nursing facility in this case. Can you talk about, there was a, I believe the number to report officially is five, is that correct? But media reports are saying that there are much, much higher cases at Meadow Park, which is the skilled nursing facility. Can you talk about how those numbers work and why is there such a disparity between what public health is reporting and what KGW has reported?
Yeah, that's a great question. So every Wednesday afternoon, the Oregon Health Authority puts out an outbreak report. They don't pull that data on Wednesdays. They pull it, I think, on Sunday evening. So the case numbers that are reflected in that report are based on data that's pulled at a different time. But the other thing to know is that, you know, people are, you know, staff may have reports of other cases at the facility or people that may have gone sick. They're going to know about those before we know about them. We get a lab report and it takes time for that to happen. The person, they go to the testing site, get their test, for it to go to the lab, and then for it to come to us and us to create a case and then have it reported to the Oregon Health Authority and included in that report. So it's not surprising that the numbers are different. I think what I would say about the, we do have three outbreaks that were reported in that Wednesday afternoon report with different case numbers. And you know, those are definitely concerning. Those are, you know, high risk populations. And it's also concerning for community spread, because the people that work there go home to a household, and people in those households work somewhere else and interact with other people. And then I know I mention this every week, but we're part of a region. And so we're not just looking at Columbia County. When you look at the outbreak report, you're going to see dozens and dozens of outbreaks across the metro region at workplaces and care facilities. So, you know, the picture right now is, to be honest, it's grim, and we have to hope that individual take personal actions for the collective good.
Okay, thank you. And Mike, at this moment, the best of your knowledge, is there an outbreak at more than one congregate care facility in Columbia County that you know of?
Yeah, I mean, if you look on the Oregon Health Authority website, again, at the outbreak report, we've had three outbreaks reported there this week: Columbia Care Center, Brookdale, Rose Valley Assisted Living Facility, and as you mentioned, Meadow Park.
Okay. And what is, once again, I ask you this every week, but it probably bears repeating, what is the best case scenario for folks who need to go out? They still need to get groceries, they still need to get gasoline. How can people best protect themselves?
Yeah, I mean, people have to go out, and it also, you know, we want people to get the medical care they need, not delay medical care as well. There's, you know, obviously you have to accept some level of risk. You know, if you have an underlying condition or you're in over, you know, 60, you want to try to work with another family member to get things delivered, to use the various different pickup options that are available at grocery stores, things like that. You know, really rely on our communities right now. And, you know, there's lots of stuff on our website about different organizations that are helping provide services and protect people. You know, wear a mask, even with around people in your family that don't live in your household. And also, you know, try not to interact with anyone. Limit your number of households you're interacting with, because, you know, you really don't know when you're interacting with another person what their interactions are like and how many contacts they come in with on a daily basis.
Well, which is why I find it curious that the current guidance is that you shouldn't gather with more than two households. Shouldn't it be just your own household? Why are they saying that it's okay to have grandma and grandpa across the street, or your brother and sister, or whichever household you choose to associate with? Why two? Why is that the minimum?
Well, I mean, it's six people. So, you know, if there's five people in your household, that's really, you know, two households, but one person from another household. And, you know, everybody's situation is different. Some people have a one person household. So I think that's why, you know, there's the two households right now. But to the extent possible, you know, this month, if you can limit your interactions, to your own household, you know, that's going to help us even more right now, help our community more.
And last question before we go to break, Mike, what is the current active, the number of the current active cases in Columbia County right at this moment?
So, you know, active number we consider people who have symptom onset in the last 10 days. That's the people are considered infectious for 10 days. So the last I checked, it's well over 50. And that, you know, goes up and down on a daily basis because of the, you know, people come on and off the list. But definitely over 50 people, maybe more closer to 70. And again, those are just people we know about. Those are lab confirmed cases. So at least 50 to 70 people with active disease that we know.
Great. All righty. Well, thanks so much. Appreciate you joining us. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to talk to three very knowledgeable people about the Electoral College and the National Popular Vote. Stay with us. There's more to come. This is Setting the Record Straight.
Columbia River Carpet One in Rainier, Oregon is open for business, and we've taken the precautions of making everything safe. So if you want to come in to buy floor covering, now's the time at Columbia River Carpet One. We've got special prices on waterproof luxury tile. We stock it, and we have it on the special price right now from $1.99 a square foot. What a great buy. Carpeting, we've got several specials right now on carpeting where you can get the carpet installed with pad at one low price. So if you want to buy carpeting or you want to buy waterproof floors, you want to come to Columbia River Carpet One in Rainier, Oregon.
Bill Eagle, I heard that Columbia County Rider has reduced their rates.
Yes, it's only $2 any place inside county.
What? $2 in county?
Only $2.
What about outside the county?
Okay, it's $3.
Okay, Bill, so that's $2 in county, $3 outside the county, and...
If you're a veteran, if you're a student, if you're a senior citizen, it's $1 in county and $2 outside of county. And that's CC Rider.
Berry Global is now hiring for all shifts at their Warren facility. Entry-level packers starting at $14 an hour. Go to berryglobal.com/careers to apply. As a Fortune 500 company, Berry offers a generous benefits package, a climate-controlled work environment, and a solid history of year-round employment. Go to berryglobal.com/careers to apply. Apply today and be eligible for a $300 signing bonus.
The freeze and COVID-19 pandemic restrictions affect us all. If your small business is affected, apply to a brand new $900,000 grant fund from Columbia County to help. Go to smallbizhub.columbiacountyoregon.com to download and apply today. The deadline is December 19th. Don't wait. Apply today. Time is short, and this is the last grant round of 2020. Applications for emergency small business grants are smallbizhub.columbiacountyoregon.com.
Why don't you just meet me in the middle? I'm losing my mind just a little.
It's Setting the Record Straight on KOHI with Melinda Bernard. Call the show now at 503-397-1600.
And we're back. You're listening to Setting the Record Straight, and we are talking about the Electoral College, the vote that is going to be happening on Monday, and National Popular Vote. My guests this morning are Casey Hansen. Casey is the chair of the Democratic Party of Oregon. Also joining us is Arthur Towers. Arthur is the political director for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And Patrick Rosensteel. Patrick is a senior consultant with the National Popular Vote. Thank you all for joining me this morning. Really appreciate it. And I'd like to start with you, Casey. I'd like to talk about who the Oregon electors are and how these folks were chosen.
Okay, sure. And every state selects their electors in a different way. What Oregon does is the elector every 4 years, two of the electors who represent the Senate positions are the chair and the vice chair of the party, one of the vice chairs of the party. And the other five electors representing the congressional districts are actually the congressional district committee chairs who in the congressional district committee is within the umbrella of the Democratic Party of Oregon. They're elected by activists who have been elected by their counties to represent at congressional district committee. So the gathering selects every 2 years, selects a chair for that committee, and the chair then becomes the elector for each of the 5 congressional districts.
So Senator Merkley, Senator Wyden.
Yeah.
Wait, we have...
No, they represent those positions.
So,
you know, we're just regular Democratic activist folk that are the electors.
So we have 6 or 7 votes.
7. We have 2 senators and 5 congressional districts. Yeah, we still get a vote in congressional district 2, even though it's been red for years.
So how does that work? Do the electors in Oregon, are they beholden to the popular vote of the people of Oregon? Or are they beholden to their party? Or how does that work? Because we do have that congressional district that is red.
Well, and that doesn't matter. There's only 2 states that are allowed to split in different ways, and that's Maine and Nebraska. So the entire electoral vote in Oregon, as in most other states, goes to the winner of the respective state. In Oregon, obviously, the Democratic nominee. And each major party has a separate set of electors. And so that's how our Democratic set of electors is chosen. It's via the state party itself. Okay. Most simply speaking.
And so where is this going? It's my understanding that electors meet in their own states.
Yes.
On Monday. Prior time. And so where is this going to be happening in Oregon? Or how is this happening? Are they meeting in person?
Yes, we meet in person. We've already signed documents attesting and pledging to vote for our nominee. And then we'll meet in Salem to officially cast our votes and in the Capitol.
And is this going to be televised?
I don't know. I imagine there might be a camera there. Who knows with COVID?
Okay.
I would imagine so. I don't know how busy of a news day it is, but you know, it is a thing.
Okay.
It's kind of a quirky, odd thing, you know, and Patrick will talk about national popular vote, which the Oregon Democratic Party has already come out in support of, you know, especially since Democrats get the short shrift every time there's been 5 cases in the past where the Democratic nominee has won the popular vote, but not the electoral vote. So, but I'll let Patrick address that.
Well, actually, I'm going to go to Arthur first. Art, can you talk about the Electoral College? Can you explain to my listeners how it came to be and what it looks like today?
Sure, Melinda, thank you for having me today. The idea in America is that there should be a one person, one vote system. And that's conventional wisdom today, but historically that hasn't always been the case. And when the Constitution was set up in the 1700s, the idea was that ordinary Americans couldn't be completely trusted to select the President of the United States. And so the founders put an additional layer into the process to the case you just described to make sure that there wasn't, I guess in their minds, mob rule. And the way the system is set up is that it disproportionately advantages small states, because as Casey pointed out, it's based on the number of members of Congress. And so a state like Delaware has about one electoral college vote for every 300,000 residents, while Oregon is looking at one electoral college vote for every 600,000 residents. So you can see it's not one person, one vote. Now, over the course of time, we've changed a lot of our practices to become more small-D democratic. We've amended the Constitution to allow African Americans to vote. We have amended the Constitution to allow women to vote. We've changed the way in which we elected U.S. senators. For many years, the legislators, the state legislature would choose the U.S. senators for each state. And now we've gone to direct popular election of U.S. senators. In the 1920s, we added, or early 1900s, we added women to have the right to vote. And then in the 60s and 70s, we had an 18-year-old. And so we're on this arc of justice to have to allow more people to participate in the process and really get towards that idea of one person, one vote. And the Electoral College is a barrier to that, and one of the last vestiges of the fight against one person, one vote.
So Patrick, what do you think? Do you think that, obviously Arthur's laid out the precedents to change the Constitution, change how we view government as a whole. You're with the National Popular Vote, so clearly you have, you know, some thoughts about this, but did the Founding Fathers have it right? Should an elite group of people vote for us? Are we too uneducated or inexperienced or out of touch to make this kind of important decision?
Well, clearly, we the decision isn't beyond the voters of the United States. And I mean, every state has given its citizens the right to vote since the adoption of these state-based winner-take-all laws. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think there's a little too much focus on the Electoral College and not enough focus on sort of having a national popular vote for president. You know, the system you see today is not the founder system, and it's no more or less the Electoral College than, you know, the congressional district system in Maine and Nebraska are, or then we'll have once enough states adopt the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact. You know, how the Electoral College operates is it's governed by 17 words in the Constitution that say each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. And if the system for electing the president is broken, it is up to the various legislatures to determine how they're going to reform that system. I think the Oregon legislature, in its infinite wisdom, in a bipartisan manner, adopted the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact that says when states with 270 or more electoral votes have our agreement in place, we are going to have a national popular vote for president. And so I try to focus people on the real discussion, which is how can we have a national popular vote for president in 2024? And there is only one way to do that, which is the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact that's been adopted by 16 states, including Oregon. And I agree with Art that when that compact is in place, when we have a national popular vote for president, electors are going to continue to do the ceremonial role that Casey talked about that they're getting ready to perform. It's just going to be that Oregon electors are going to be based on the party that won the most popular votes in all 50 states and the District of Columbia instead of who won the most popular votes in Oregon. And what that will do is fulfill sort of that foundational principle of American democracy, which is how do we have this principle of one person, one vote in presidential elections. And another way to say that is how do we make sure that every voter in every state is politically relevant in every presidential election, which is in the best interest of a majority of the states and certainly in the best interest of the American voter. So, you know, the reason that I'm a proponent of a national popular vote for president is because I believe a voter in Oregon should be as important as a voter in Orlando, Florida. And clearly the current system does not deliver on that when a battleground state voter is so much more important in presidential elections than flyover state voters. So, you know, if you want a national popular vote for president, there's only one way to really get it, which is the plan at nationalpopularvote.com. Oregon is already a member of the compact. 15 other states have joined them. If we can convince our friends in other states with 74 more electoral votes, we will have a national popular vote for president. And every one of our votes will be meaningful in the next presidential election, which is something worth pursuing.
Go ahead, Art.
Yeah, Art Towers here. I would just jump in and say this is not necessarily a partisan issue. I mean, you look at a state like California, 6 million voters in California voted for Donald Trump. And they have exactly zero votes in the Electoral College because of the statewide winner-take-all system. And so right now, as Casey pointed out, Democrats have been winning the popular vote and losing the Electoral College. But in the one-sided states, it's 178 popular or Electoral College votes for Democrats, 113 for Republicans, and roughly. And so you can see that down the road someplace, the Electoral College may favor the Democrats over the Republicans. So I'll leave it there. But again, I just want to get that idea across.
Okay, great. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to talk about how currently 33 states have a law requiring electors to vote to accept the popular vote when they cast their vote. So we're going to talk about how that may play out on Monday. So stay with us. This is Setting the Record Straight. We'll be right back.
Columbia River Carpet One in Rainier, Oregon is open for business, and we've taken the precautions of making everything safe. So if you want to come in to buy floor covering, now's the time at Columbia River Carpet One. We've got special prices on waterproof luxury tile. We stock it, and we have it on a special price right now from $1.99 a square foot. What a great buy. Carpeting, we've got several specials right now on carpeting where you can get the carpet installed with pad at one low price. So if you want to buy carpeting or you want to buy waterproof floors, you want to come to Columbia River Carpet One in Rainier, Oregon.
Bill Eagle, I heard that Columbia County Rider has reduced their rates.
Yes, it's only $2 any place inside county.
What? $2 in county?
Only $2.
What about outside the county?
Okay, it's $3.
Okay, Bill, so that's $2 in county, $3 outside the county, and...
If you're a veteran, if you're a student, if you're a senior citizen, it's $1 in county and $2 outside of county. And that's CC Rider.
Berry Global is now hiring for all shifts at their Warren facility. Entry-level packers starting at $14 an hour. Go to berryglobal.com/careers to apply. As a Fortune 500 company, Berry offers a generous benefits package, a climate-controlled work environment, and a solid history of year-round employment. Go to berryglobal.com/careers to apply. Apply today and be eligible for a $300 signing bonus.
The freeze and COVID-19 pandemic restrictions affect us all. If your small business is affected, apply to a brand new $900,000 grant fund from Columbia County to help. Go to smallbizhub.columbiacountyoregon.com to download and apply today. The deadline is December 19th. Don't wait. Apply today. Time is short, and this is the last grant round of 2020. Applications for emergency small business grants are smallbizhub.columbiacountyoregon.com.
Why don't you just meet me in the middle? I'm losing my mind just a little.
It's Setting the Record Straight on KOHI with Melinda Bernard. Call the show now at 503-397-1600.
And we're back. Welcome to Setting the Record Straight. We're talking about the Electoral College, the national popular vote, and what we might be seeing on Monday when electors all over the country, and including the District of Columbia, meet to cast their vote for the President and the Vice President of the United States. And once again, joining me this morning is the Democratic Party Chair of Oregon, Casey Hansen. Arthur Towers, he is the political representative for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. And Patrick Rosensteel. Patrick is with the National Popular Vote. Welcome, everyone. Thank you again. And before break, we're talking about how electors were chosen, but interestingly enough, only 33 states and the District of Columbia have laws that bind the electors to vote for the people's choice or follow their party's choice, which leaves us with 17, 18, I guess, if you're counting District of Columbia. Is it possible that on Monday we might see electors doing whatever they want regardless of how their state voted? Who wants to answer? Patrick, you're shaking your head.
Well, I just think the short answer is no. I mean, I think Casey pointed us in the direction, which is every elector from every state is sort of tied to their vote through party loyalty. I mean, it's not like any of these electors are left to chance. What ties in their loyalty is their loyalty to the Democratic Party in Oregon, for example, because you have a state-based winner-take-all law, and the Democrats have one function on Monday, which is to cast their ballots for Joe Biden. And I would expect all seven electors from Oregon to do that. You're talking about faithless electors, which aren't generally a problem in presidential elections. Yes, states are able to adopt what are called faithless elector laws. In fact, we have one in my state of Minnesota. It operates as a trap door, which means that if any sort of Democrat casts their ballot for Donald Trump, they'll throw out that elector, and the rest of the electors will get together and cast that ballot in the state of Minnesota. The reason why every state doesn't need them is because electors are party loyalists who have one job. But I expect the result will be the result on Monday, and the one that folks expect based on the state statutes that were used to run the campaigns.
Thank you. Do any of you, Art or Casey, clearly, I don't think you're going to see a problem here in Oregon, Casey, but
no.
Do you potentially see a problem in some of these other states, that Florida, for instance?
I don't. I think Patrick laid it out pretty well. I think that, again, the core problem goes back to the one person, one vote principle. I think that the faithless electors, it's strange. It hasn't flipped one yet, right? But for many years, we never talked about the Electoral College as a thing. It was just a sideshow, a footnote, because between 1888 and 2000, the winner of the popular vote won the electoral vote each and every time. And so it's just, for newer Americans or younger voters, there just wasn't quite the level of attention paid to the Electoral College up until 2000, even though there were a few elections, 1960, 1968, 1976, where some states were very closely decided and could have flipped based on just a handful of votes. But it's only been the last couple or five elections, I guess, where there's really been heightened attention paid to the Electoral College.
Well, and certainly now there's a lot of attention being paid because of the behavior of the current president. And, there's 50 odd different small to medium lawsuits that have been, brought to try to reverse the will of the people and in individual states. And this latest effort with the, led by the charge of the Texas Attorney General Paxton to literally throw out the electoral votes of four of the key swing states that went Biden's way. Well, as AG Joel Shapiro in Pennsylvania said, and I want to quote this because it's a great quote, that effort has no place in law or fact, and the court, i.e. the Supreme Court, should not abide this seditious abuse of judicial process. And that's exactly what it is.
Thank you, Casey. So Patrick, let's talk about the national popular vote. It takes 270 electoral votes to elect the president, and the national popular vote bill will take effect once you have enough states that have that add up to 270 electoral votes. Once they've enacted the bill, as Oregon did in 2019, and the reason we have 270 votes, correct, is because it's the majority of the 538 electoral votes that we currently have. So where's it going? How are we doing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that was a perfect description. So good for you. And to say it another way, that means we need states with 74 more electoral votes to pass the bill to have a national popular vote for president. Where are we going? I mean, we're very active in every state that has not acted the national popular vote interstate compact. I think what most people in Art was pointing to us to this earlier, which is, the national popular vote for president is not a Republican or a Democrat idea. It's not an independent idea. It's an American idea. That's time has come. We have also passed one chamber or another in nine additional states, where we either pass the House or the Senate or both and were vetoed by a governor. Those states have 86 electoral votes, right? More than the 74 required. And they're not, you know, they're not just Democrat states. I mean, we passed the Arizona House of Representatives. We passed the Oklahoma Senate. You know, we are a nonpartisan. You're talking to a Republican who's trapped behind the blue wall in Minnesota who supports a national popular vote for president. And the reason that I do is because I believe a Republican in Minnesota should matter as much as a Democrat in Oklahoma. And we shouldn't all be focused on the voting procedures of the battleground states and stuck with a system where networks are declaring presidents and courts are deciding who won, right? So I think the way it gets done is it gets done in a bipartisan fashion, just like it did in Oregon, where I would argue that Senator Boquist and Senator Thompson offered the deciding votes to join the compact in a bipartisan way, along with progressives and Democrats who absolutely believe in the foundational principle of one person, one vote. So what we do every morning is we ask you whether or not you believe the principle of one person, one vote should matter in presidential elections. We ask you to, if you believe that the candidate should be forced to campaign to all 50 states if they want to be president of the United States, and if you believe the voters, not the court, should decide the outcome. And if you answer any one of those three questions, yes, we ask you to get on board. And we don't take force anybody to take a loyalty oath to party or political movement. We think this is one of those issues where the best thing we can do is set down our jerseys, get our shoulder to the wheel, petition the legislatures, take it to the people if necessary. We just got done winning a ballot measure in Colorado, which proves that the popular vote is popular. And it was Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. We carried rural counties, suburban counties, and urban counties, because at the end of the day, people are tired of presidents who govern to battleground states and politicians who pander to battleground states. We want to elect a president of the United States. And, you know, if you agree, one great way to do it is, you know, go to nationalpopularvote.com, read up on the plan, hit volunteer, donate, and to write your legislator, whether your state's in it or not, because you writing them tells them you want them to stay in it, and get engaged and get involved. And with your help, we'll get it done.
Thank you so much for that explanation, Patrick. So who are your opponents? Who would oppose a national popular vote? Why stick with the Electoral College? It's clearly outdated.
And this is Patrick again, and I'll answer this quickly because I just want to make room for everybody else. But you know, the truth is a national popular vote for president has both bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition. The people who are opposed us are the people who are afraid of change. The people who are opposed us are the people who are afraid of the American voter. And, you know, I've got Democrats who block my bill when Democrats believe they had a virtual lock on the Electoral College. Right? How'd that work out in 2016? Right? I had Republicans, frankly, the first time I was approached, I was like, man, this sounds like the communist plot to gut the Constitution and make Al Gore president. And then I thought for a minute about, boy, if we had a campaign to all 50 states in the District of Columbia, am I really afraid of the American voter and am I really afraid of my ideas? And the answer to that question is no. And so, you know, I think the biggest opponent to the national popular vote interstate compacts is those who oppose change and are afraid of change. And I don't like change. I don't like it for change's sake. But I can't think of a single redeeming quality to the current system we use to elect the president of the United States. It's a systemic problem that requires legislative action. And I encourage every legislator I know, Republican, Democrat, or otherwise, to get on board. Because you can either get on board or get run over. It's up to you at this point.
Well, I'm kind of curious, Patrick. What states are up to bat in the coming state legislative sessions?
Yeah, I generally, you know, I don't make predictions, right? Because if I had made predictions, I would have made a prediction on Oregon a long time ago. We got Oregon, and it took several cycles to get through some resistance on the Democratic leadership side of things. That was the roadblock in Oregon, was the Democrat president of the Senate. But I always point people to the, you know, the facts, which is we have passed one legislative chamber or another in nine additional states. Some of those states are places like Michigan, where in 2018, we introduced our bill in the Michigan Senate with 15 Republican sponsors and 10 Democratic sponsors, right? I point them to states like Arkansas. The Arizona House of Representatives passed our bill. The Oklahoma Senate passed our bill. The Virginia House passed the bill just last year, and the Senate is taking it in under consideration early in the next legislative session. So there's also states where we've had unanimous committee support, states like Georgia, which is currently looking more and more like a battleground state, states like Missouri, where we passed unanimously out of committee. So there are many, many viable paths to 270 electoral votes before the 2024 presidential election. The question is everybody going to go to national popular vote? Are you going to get on board and volunteer to make phone calls in some of these states that haven't passed? Are you going to contribute to the effort that makes sure we got the lobby and political teams on the ground to get it done? And, you know, there's a lot of viable paths.
Great. Thank you, Patrick. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to wrap up our conversation about the Electoral College and the national popular vote. Stay with us. This is Setting the Record Straight.
Columbia River Carpet One in Rainier, Oregon is open for business, and we've taken the precautions of making everything safe. So if you want to come in to buy floor covering, now's the time at Columbia River Carpet One. We've got special prices on waterproof luxury tile. We stock it, and we have it on a special price right now from $1.99 a square foot. What a great buy. Carpeting, we've got several specials right now on carpeting where you can get the carpet installed with pad at one low price. So if you want to buy carpeting or you want to buy waterproof floors, you want to come to Columbia River Carpet One in Rainier, Oregon.
Bill Eagle, I heard that Columbia County Rider has reduced their rates.
Yes, it's only $2 any place inside county.
What? $2 in county?
Only $2.
What about outside the county?
Okay, it's $3.
Okay, Bill, so that's $2 in county, $3 outside the county, and...
If you're a veteran, if you're a student, if you're a senior citizen, it's $1 in county and $2 outside of county. And that's CC Rider.
Berry Global is now hiring for all shifts at their Warren facility. Entry-level packers starting at $14 an hour. Go to berryglobal.com/careers to apply. As a Fortune 500 company, Berry offers a generous benefits package, a climate-controlled work environment, and a solid history of year-round employment. Go to berryglobal.com/careers to apply. Apply today and be eligible for a $300 signing bonus.
The freeze and COVID-19 pandemic restrictions affect us all. If your small business is affected, apply to a brand new $900,000 grant fund from Columbia County to help. Go to smallbizhub.columbiacountyoregon.com to download and apply today. The deadline is December 19th. Don't wait. Apply today. Time is short, and this is the last grant round of 2020. Applications for emergency small business grants are smallbizhub.columbiacountyoregon.com.
Why don't you just meet me in the middle? I'm losing my mind just a little.
It's Setting the Record Straight on KOHI with Melinda Bernard. Call the show now at 503-397-1600.
And we're back. We're wrapping up our conversation this morning about the Electoral College and the national popular vote. And I'd like to talk about Monday. Monday, the electors are going to meet in each state and the District of Columbia, and they're going to cast their votes. Once those votes are cast, I believe it is January 6th, both sessions of Congress meet, they look at the votes, and they announce the winner. But in the meantime, there has been, as many of you know, there's been numerous lawsuits filed within this election. But the latest and really the most egregious is one that was filed in Texas by the AG, Ken Paxton, who, by the way, is under federal investigation himself. He has now been joined by how many other AGs was that, Casey?
17 other Republican AGs. Not all Republican AGs have joined them. I believe Idaho, for one, the Republican Attorney General there, has not joined the suit. 24 Democratic AGs are in opposition to the suit.
Right.
So but, of course, the defendants are the four swing states he's attacking.
Right. So 17 attorneys general have glommed onto the suit, claiming that these four states were somehow infringing on, I don't even understand, Texas's rights by allowing mail-in ballots, which of course is so foreign to us here in Oregon because we've had mail-in ballots for what, 20 years? So what do you all yep. think that this is going to be problematic? Is this going to have an impact on the outcome of actually Biden being inaugurated on January 20th?
I'm going to let the legal eagle, Arthur, address that, but I just want to say that it's horrific in its optics, because what these folks are saying is that the voters in those swing states don't matter at all, and Texas is trying to claim that they have some kind of standing where they do not in Pennsylvania, Georgia, or the others. And but it's a pretty appalling that this is dragging out so long. But Arthur, I'll let you address the legal eagle part of this.
Yeah, and so, to be clear, I represent an organization that's issue-driven, mission-driven, democracy-driven, that's operating in a very partisan context. And I'm glad that the courts are available for legitimate challenges to the election. That's part of the process. The dilemma that we've had in this instance is that no evidence has been brought forth that any court has found credible. And so that's the violation of small d democratic norms that we're seeing here. And so the sort of reform that we're talking about here is getting us back to the idea of what democracy should be all about. The idea that every person's created equal, every person should have an equal voice, and every vote should count the same. And the observation I'd make about where we are once we get beyond this moment in time of the transition to a new president is that we've got to stay true to the idea of small d democracy. I feel like that's the threat that we're seeing here, is there's been a lot of challenges to that, to the small d democratic process. And people, the first time I heard about the national popular vote idea, I felt like, gee whiz, that's pretty far out there. That's a pretty radical concept. And the more I learn about it, the more common sense it becomes. And you think about it, 120 years ago, it was a radical idea for women to vote. And now it's, run of the mill. Not something no one gives a second thought to. The idea that we get to, as citizens, we get a chance to vote for our U.S. senators. Again, common sense, something we all take for granted today, but was a radical notion back in the 19th century. And so similarly, people are going to look back to us 100 years from now and say, I can't believe they had a system where they didn't have a national popular vote for the presidency. It, of course, is the right, the most small d democratic way to do things. And so we've got to overcome the moment that we're in, where there's so many challenges to the democratic process, and persevere to the point where we do have a national popular vote.
Okay, thank you. I have a listener question. The listener would like to know what you all think, if you think that Citizens United, that decision, has had any effect on the popular vote system.
On the popular vote system, it certainly has an impact on campaign financing.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're totally, independent kind of topics. I would say that if what you're concerned about is the concentration of money in politics, you should be very concerned about the concentration of money in politics when you can shrink it to the concentration of money in politics in battleground states. And by that, what I mean is, like, they spent $174 million in 2012 running for president in the battleground state of Florida, while ignoring 35 other states. So if you're worried about the concentration of money in politics, I would argue the solution to pollution is dilution. And that if you force candidates to campaign across all 50 states, it will dilute sort of the direct impact of money on any one state.
Okay, great. And we have another listener call regarding the Texas suit we were just talking about. isn't the suit about the election laws that were changed prior to the election and the fact that they were changed by secretaries of state instead of the legislature? Yeah,
that's what the entire case is about. I mean, the case, I agree with Casey, by the way, that the problem with the case is not the argument. The problem with the case is standing, because the Constitution, if you open it up and read it, it says each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. So the crux of the Texas case is that the legislatures in the four states they have challenged did not change their voting laws around mail-in ballots, and that was determined by governors, secretaries of states, and courts. And the governors and secretary of states and courts are not the legislature of those states. So the legal argument is fairly sound. The problem is the plaintiffs, right? Because it says each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. The power of the individual legislature is what's at case here, and what Texas has no standing to tell the Georgia legislature or the state of Georgia what to do with their electors. Now, if the lawsuit was a Georgia citizen, or if the lawsuit was a Pennsylvania citizen or a Michigan citizen against their legislature, you would have real standing there and a pretty compelling argument. But if you had a national popular vote for president, you could avoid it all, right? And we could end this system that is unnecessary recounts. That what all it gives us is unnecessary recounts, endless lawsuits, networks picking presidents, and courts deciding. Let's have an election of the American people. Let's do it under national popular vote. And you know, every 4 years, let's line up and beat each other and see who wins. We might get better at living with the results. That would be okay with me.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And I really want to talk about your point that the West Coast, we're not battleground states. We're very blue, or perhaps a state that's very red is going to be ignored because they think, well, they're already locked in, but nobody is campaigning. They're just focusing on the same states over and over and over, which really doesn't go for, we're not giving everyone the option to have their voice heard. And especially if you look at California, which has a GDP that's higher than some small countries. There's some real issues here. And I just thought it's very interesting that some people are dug in currently because maybe it's politically expedient for them now. But as Art has pointed out, sometime in the future, the Electoral College may swing in favor from the Democrats, but it shouldn't matter. It should matter the national popular vote, which I have to point out, Hillary won, and clearly Joe Biden has not only won the national popular vote, but he has also won the Electoral College. So do you anticipate any problems happening on January 6th, when Congress meets to officially read and declare the winner? Anyone?
I don't. I believe that the states have certified their election results under the law that was in place on Election Day, which is the state-based winner-take-all law that has been passed by all the legislatures, and I expect that those certificates of ascertainment will be read, those votes will be counted, and the result will be the result.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And Casey, are you one of the electors that gets to vote?
Oh, yeah. Chair of the party. I'll be down there.
I figured. Well, excellent. I just want to thank you all again, Patrick Rosensteel, Casey Hansen, and Arthur Towers, for joining me this morning. Thank you so much. It's been very, very informative.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be
back next Friday with another edition of Setting the Record Straight. Have a great week, everyone. Make sure you wear your masks. We'll see you next week.
Why don't you just meet me in the middle? I'm losing my mind just a little.
You've been listening to Setting the Record Straight with Melinda Bernard on KOHI. Listen again next Friday here on AM 1600. You can email the show, kohi.radio@gmail.com, or email Melinda, strsradio@gmail.com.